Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Less than a week has passed since the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, where a lone gunman killed down 20 young elementary school students in their classroom and seven others, including his mother. Yesterday, the first funeral for one of the youngest victims was held. But even amid the grief, we're looking for answers still. What causes such violence and how can we prevent it? Some say that the nation's liberal gun laws are at the root of the problem. Others suggest that our attitudes about violence in general are the problem. And in more specifically, its depiction in the media, especially video games, are at the heart of the problem. Joining us now to talk about that is Ohio State University professor Brad Bushman, who studies the causes, consequences, and solutions to the problem of human aggression and violence and the impact of media. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your latest study shows a relationship between violent video gameplay and aggressive behavior. And I wondered first if we could talk about what we mean by aggressive and versus violence.
Sure. Aggression is any attempt to harm another person. It could be physical harm or psychological harm. But violence refers to any attempt to physically harm another person, you know, injure them, or even kill them.
And what in your study, what about your study, was it a correlative relationship or a causal relationship in your study?
It was a causal relationship.
So tell us what caused what?
Yes, people often wonder, is it just a correlation between exposure to violent media and aggression, or is it a cause-effect relationship?
Meaning, are violent people more prone or aggressive people more prone to play violent video games?
Right. So in an experimental study, we don't ask people, do you want to play the violent game or the nonviolent game? Because if we do, different types of people might choose to play the violent game. And if they're more aggressive afterwards, we don't know if it's because of the kind of person they are or the game they played. And so what we do is we flip a coin to determine whether they play a violent or nonviolent game. And on average, the violent game player should be just as aggressive as the nonviolent game players before they play anything, because you flipped a coin to determine what group they're in. And then you treat the two groups identically except for the game they play. And then you measure aggressive behavior afterwards. Obviously, you can't give participants knives and guns in a laboratory and see what they'll do with them. So researchers have to use other types of aggression, such as blasting them with loud noise through headphones. We use a combination of noises that most people hate, like fingernails scratching on a chalkboard and dentist drills and sirens. Or you can give electrical shock to another person. You can make them eat hot sauce. You can force them to shove their hand in ice-cold water for a certain amount of time. And if violent game players are more aggressive than nonviolent game players, then the only thing that could have caused the difference was the game they played or just a random fluke. And scientists are very careful and do stringent statistical tests to make sure that it's not a random fluke.
The students in this study were French.
They were.
Any cultural adjustments?
No, we actually did a comprehensive review of all studies ever conducted on violent video games. I think there are 381 studies involving over 130,000 participants. And we found that violent video games increase aggressive thoughts, they increase angry feelings, they increase physiological arousal, such as heart rate and blood pressure, they increase aggressive behavior, they decrease helping behavior, and they decrease feelings of empathy and compassion for others. And we found the effects for males and females of all ages, regardless of where they lived in the world. So they play the same violent games in France as we play in the United States.
My guest is Brad Bushman. He's a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. We're talking about his latest study that shows a relationship between violent video game play and aggressive behavior. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email from Arlen. Arlen writes, does the type of game make a difference on the player of the game? For example, StarCraft is a real-time strategy game. Star Wars, The Old Republic, is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And Doom is a first-person shooter. So did you play around with those different sorts of violent games.
Yeah, recently we've started to look at games, video games, in which you play with other participants. And generally, they have a weaker effect on aggressive behavior than if you play alone.
I think I've talked about that with people before, and that is that there's some a level of camaraderie,
yes,
which creates a little bit more empathy and that sort of thing,
right,
in the player. In the study, the students who participated were assigned to play a violent or nonviolent video game for 20 minutes on each of three consecutive days. And the number of days notwithstanding, most gamers play a lot more than 20 minutes a day.
Right.
You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So even in 20 minutes a day, you were able to measure change.
Yes, yes. And many experiments have done that. Most experiments last maybe an hour. Participants play a video game 15 or 20 minutes, and even after playing only 15 or 20 minutes, they're more aggressive. But what our study looks at is the cumulative effects over time. So we found violent game players were more aggressive than nonviolent game players on day one, but the difference was even larger on day two, and on day three it was larger still.
I was really interested by the notion that they didn't become more violent themselves per se, but rather came to view the world as more hostile and violent a place and expected others to behave aggressively, so that their potential for violence was more a defensive type of getting ready for the worst mode.
Yeah, we measured aggressive behavior. They could blast another person with unpleasant noise, but we also measured what you talked about, these hostile expectations. That is, we had them. I can read an example,
sure,
of one of the stories. Todd was on his way home from work one evening when he stopped quickly for a yellow light. The driver behind him must have thought Todd was going to run the light because he crashed into the back of Todd's car, causing a lot of damage. Fortunately, no one got hurt. Todd got out of his car and surveyed the damage. He then walked over to the other car, and then we ask him what happens next. List the 20 things that Todd will do or say, think, and feel as the story continues. And then we have independent raters code their responses. You know, some people say, Todd, kick the other guy's butt or something. And what we found is that violent game players expected Todd to respond with more aggression than nonviolent game players did. And when we expect others to respond with aggression, we're more aggressive ourselves.
When you're doing the baseline beforehand, I imagine this is a matter of change in violent or aggressive behavior, right, that you're measuring, or not necessarily?
Well, in a normal experiment, because people are randomly assigned to groups, the baseline should be the same. But in our study, one advantage of it is we could look at change from day one to day two to day three.
Okay.
And we found across the 3 days, not only did aggressive behavior increase, but also hostile expectations increased.
You've also studied how the presence of stress, in this case via the violent video games, may be part of the issue, that it's stress, not necessarily violence per se, or...
Well, that was in a different study.
Okay.
And we found that playing violent video games stress people out. And when people feel stressed out, they're more likely to behave aggressively. But that was a different study we did.
But there's a lot of games you could play that create stress without being violent.
Correct.
Aren't there?
Yes. Yeah, the difference is the way you handle stress in a violent game is by killing people, and people are trying to kill you, and that's very, very stressful. And people who are relaxed and calm are much less likely to behave aggressively than somebody who's stressed out.
Any distinction between video games that where there's killing, but it's not people that you're killing, but supposedly aliens or some non-human life form?
Not much. My colleague did a study in which the victims had either green blood or red blood, and both types of video games increased aggression.
You've also studied whether relaxing video games have the opposite effect of violent games.
Yes, we have.
Could you tell me what a relaxing video game would be like?
Yeah, well, one of the video games we used, for example, was called Endless Ocean, and you just explore the ocean, and there's many beautiful fish, and none of them can eat you. And there's beautiful coral reefs, and it's calm music, and those kind of games decrease aggressive behavior and actually increase helping cooperative behavior.
What about the kind of games like the football games and hockey and those kinds of video games?
Yeah, if they're violent, then they're more likely to increase aggression than
physical
if they're
contact,
nonviolent.
That kind of thing.
But, you know, anything that even increases physiological arousal can contribute to aggression.
You know, we're heading in a direction where things are getting 3D, they're getting multimedia, tactile, where they're, you know, the seats are vibrating and that sort of a thing. Do you see that just heading down farther down the same road?
Yeah, actually, my PhD student, Bobby Lowell, just finished a study where he randomly assigned people to play a violent versus a nonviolent game, either on a desktop computer, two-dimension, small screen, on a geo wall, which is a like 6-foot by 8-foot screen, two-dimension, or a geo wall, a 6-foot by 8-foot screen in 3-dimension. And then we measured how angry they felt afterwards. And the level of anger was higher if you played the violent game on a big screen in 3D. People also became more immersed in the game, the larger the screen and in 3D as opposed to 2D.
You've studied how video games are good training tools, too. It teaches people. It's not just a joke. I think it was a Starfighter. The Last Starfighter was one of those early movies that dealt with that concept. And of course, Orson Scott Card has dealt with it in his Ender game, his Ender series too.
Yeah, we've done research in which we've had people play a violent shooting game, and the targets were humanoid targets that you would kill by shooting them in the head. Zombies, they shot at bullseye targets, or they played a nonviolent game, Mario. And then we also manipulated whether the control was in the shape of a gun or whether it was a standard controller with buttons. And then we gave them an airsoft pistol. These are the kind of pistols that are used to train police officers and military personnel, and told them to shoot at a target at the end of the hall that was covered in Velcro, and they shot these Velcro balls at the target. We didn't tell them where to shoot or where to aim, and what we found is that people who played the violent shooting game with the humanoid targets were more accurate and were also more likely to aim for the head.
Well, Brad Bushman, thanks for talking about this with us today. It was interesting.
You're welcome.
Brad Bushman, he's professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. When we return, we'll be talking about something more upbeat, holiday gift giving. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The worst of this summer's drought is over, but for farmers and ranchers and the people who live off the land, it changed the way they do business.
We're trying to help each other. That's how I found out where some of my hay was from my neighbors, you know.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, getting by in a drought year for cattle ranchers. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APN.
And Marketplace is tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 40 degrees in downtown Columbus with a chance of rain today, a high of 46. Clouds tonight, a low of 34. Mostly sunny and a high of 51 on Wednesday. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, announcing the opening of the Spirit of Women Park, thanks to the generous support of the Ingram family. Located near the Wexner Medical Center, the Spirit of Women Park features thousands of hand-painted tiles donated by donors to honor special women in their lives. Medicalcenter.osu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Tablets are at the top of many holiday wish lists this year, and there is more variety than ever from which to choose. Joining us now to cut through the confusion is Troy Wolverton, who writes the Tech Files column as the personal technology columnist at the San Jose Mercury News. Welcome to the show, Troy.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Ann.
You've said that the iPad is not necessarily the best pad for everyone. Who would it not necessarily suit?
Well, you pay a premium for an iPad. You can pay as much as, you know, $100 or $200 more for an iPad, for the full-sized iPad, compared with some of the Android-based tablets. And the iPad Mini, the new smaller iPad that Apple released this fall, is priced about $130 more than comparable tablets from Google and some of the other tablet makers. So, you know, you can save money by not picking an iPad. So in that sense, you know, everybody likes to save money. So in that sense, there's a chance that there's a better tablet for you, if only because it's less expensive.
Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to get, like, say, it kind of depends on what you really want to do with the tablet.
That's true. So one of the interesting things about this year is that you have far greater choice in tablets than you've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
So you not only have the tablets from Apple, but Microsoft just released its own tablets, one of the first times it stepped into making hardware outside of game systems, that has some tablets called the Surface tablets. You've got tablets from Google. You've got tablets from a bunch of different computer makers like Acer. And you have a whole bunch of choice that you didn't have before, and they come in a lot of different varieties and shapes and sizes. So you have everything from basically glorified e-readers or devices that started off as e-readers and evolved, such as the Kindle Fire or the Nook tablet from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, respectively, to devices like the Surface or some of the new computers coming out from, like, IBM that double as laptops. So they can serve as a tablet or they can serve as a full laptop computer.
You've written a cautionary column about the hybrids, the crosses between tablets and traditional computers.
Right.
Tell us about what cautions you issue people.
Well, the problem with those tablets, so those tablets are largely being designed around the new Windows 8 operating system from Microsoft. There are some Android tablets that are hybrids as well, but many of the ones that are coming out now are Windows 8 tablets. And the problem with the Windows 8 tablets is that they, or the Windows 8 hybrids, is that they aren't very good at either being a tablet or being a laptop computer. One of the things that Windows 8 does is that it has a touch-based interface that looks like something you would use on a touch screen that was originally called Metro, is now called the Windows 8 interface, and it has the original desktop interface. But the dumb thing about Windows 8 is that it's not context-aware. So when you have a keyboard, it doesn't necessarily switch over to the desktop interface, even though that's the best interface for use with a keyboard. And when you're using it just as a touchscreen, you can still get to the desktop interface, even though it's really a crummy experience to use a touchscreen with the old desktop computer. That's one of the problems with it. One of the great things about the iPad tablet is that Apple designed it in such a way that it's usable either in portrait mode, kind of in a vertical orientation, or in horizontal mode, like a landscape orientation. And it's very easy to use either way. And many of the tablets that are not iPads are designed in a different way, so that they're kind of oblong. They're much more rectangular than the iPad is. That is great for use in landscape mode. It gives you a lot of screen real estate, but it's not so great an experience if you're trying to hold it in vertical mode. It's very uncomfortable to hold that way and not so usable. There are kind of design problems, both in terms of the hardware design and in terms of the software design with interacting with some of these hybrid tablets.
There are different criteria, I guess. From Sherry on Facebook, she writes, when we are shopping for a tablet, what should we ask the salesperson, and what things should we specifically try on the device?
That's a good question. You know, I did a guide the other day about kind of trying to go through some of the choices that people go through in trying to pick out a tablet. And, you know, there are a number of things that you need to consider. One is that you need to figure out how much you want to spend, because you can spend anywhere from, you know, less than $200 all the way up to, you know, more than $1,000. You need to figure out what types of things you want to do with the tablet, because if you're wanting to do productivity things, you want to type something in Word, or you want to use Excel, you're going to have to choose probably a Windows tablet. It's going to be easier to do that on a Windows tablet. If you want to have a wide range of applications and wide range of games and things, maybe an iPad that you want to choose. So you kind of have to go in and maybe do some research beforehand in terms of trying to figure out what tablet you want, based on, you know, some select criteria, whether it's price or whether it's the number of applications or the type of applications you want to run, whether it's, you know, what kind of size you want, and whether or not you want to have to be able to get onto the internet when you're not at home. Some tablets, like the iPad, give you the opportunity of getting an optional radio that allows you to get onto the internet via the cellular networks, and so you're not dependent on your home Wi-Fi.
Right. Then there's a cellular radio option. Is that what you were just talking about?
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. It costs more money, though, right?
Yes, it does. So on an iPad, it costs, I think the option is $130 more. It's less expensive on some Android tablets. I think that the premium on, like, the Google Nexus 7 is maybe $50. I can't remember exactly. It's something in that neighborhood, though.
You're listening.
But that's just for the hardware. So, you know, you then, to get onto the internet, you'd have to pay an additional cost, usually on a monthly basis, mm-hmm. so you can sign up one month and cancel the next, for getting onto the internet with that device via the cell network.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Troy Wolverton, personal technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. We're talking about how to pick out a tablet this year. It's the top of many holiday wish lists. If you have a question or comment for Troy, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Apps are another consideration. I mean, if you're hooked on, you know, a certain kind of app group, that's one thing. But there are hundreds of thousands of apps out there. What do you want to look for when it comes to the different options in terms of tablets?
Well, I would say that, you know, unless you have experience with a tablet or a smartphone and know that there are certain apps that you absolutely want to have, you probably need to think about how you likely are to use the device. So are you going to use it mainly to surf the web? Are you going to use it mainly to check your email? Are you going to use it mainly to play games? Are you going to use it to, you know, read e-books? That they're depending on what you... how you answer those questions, it may shape what your decision is. So, you know, all the tablets have web browsers and they have email clients, and they have some selection of games. But, you know, depending on if there are particular games that you like, you may find them on one app or one tablet and maybe not another. We were talking earlier about Microsoft Office. Microsoft Office is only available on the Windows tablets. It's not available on the iPad. It's not available on the Android tablets. So if that's important to you, you might want to pick a Windows tablet. You know, there are classes of applications too. Right now there are far more applications that have been customized for tablets for the iPad than there are for the other tablets. So, you know, in general, if you're looking for a wide range of applications and you have an idea that you might be using your tablet for a lot of different things, the iPad may end up being the best choice, if only because you have a far greater diversity of applications available to you.
Is there a tablet out there that, in general, outside of the iPad, you think is the best buy?
I really like the Google Nexus devices, particularly the Google Nexus 7. This is a $200 tablet from Google. It's a 7-inch tablet. It has the latest version of the Android operating system on it, which Google has refined greatly over the years, so it's much more user-friendly. It's much easier to use. And it has, you know, built-in applications for media. You've got the Google Play Store, so you can download movies and books from that store. And it has a neat feature called Google Now, which is kind of like Apple's Siri assistant, except that it's even better. One of the cool things about Google Now is that it can look at your calendar and look at prevailing traffic conditions and tell you when you need to leave to make that particular appointment. That's something that Siri, and we'll do that on its own. It won't, you know, you don't have to speak into it to ask for that information.
Do you need to set it up to do that, though?
You do. I think you have to activate it once you turn on the device.
Are you surprised at the popularity of tablets for children? Because it's a pricey gift, although, you know, certain Legos block combinations are pretty darn pricey these days, too. But are you surprised by that? And do you think it's a useful gift for a young child?
Oh, gosh. I'm not surprised that kids like them. You know, my kids have loved my wife's and my iPhones for years and are always grabbing for them. So the idea that you have something similar that's on a bigger screen is a no-brainer that they would want to play with that. Considering that the prices have come down so much, it's not a surprise. I mean, you know, when the only option was the iPad at $500, well, that limits the number of people that are going to be able to afford that, and certainly the number of people that are going to want to give that to their kids. But when you can get tablets now for, you know, $200 or less, that makes it much more accessible, and it becomes more of a device that, you know, if the kids spill their juice on it, you're not going to be as unhappy about it. In terms of whether it's an appropriate gift for a kid, I don't know. There are tablets that have come out that are designed with kids in mind, and they, you know, have much more curtailed experiences in terms of the number of apps that are available, or, you know, they have designed them, the applications in the interface, with children in mind. I don't think it's a bad thing for kids to play with tablets, but I'm not sure that it's necessarily, I don't know, you know, whether it's an appropriate gift or not, that's probably up to other people to decide. You know, I guess I would say that I have my doubts about the educational benefit of putting these in kids' hands. I don't think it's some kind of magic bullet that some people like to think it is.
It's amazing. I was watching a child playing with an iPhone the other night, and a young kid, and it's just very comfortable for them to play around with those devices. They don't think anything of it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I guess I've read a couple things about this, about how just how natural that interface is, the ability to touch the screen and immediately and directly interact with the device, and how odd that kids are going to think it is to interact with a computer with a mouse and a keyboard, because it's a much more mediated experience, a much more indirect experience. They take to these devices very, very quickly.
I've heard about kids walking up to big television screens and touching them with their fingers.
Right.
Expecting to move stuff around. We have a question from Pava on Facebook. They ask, which devices can I download books on, and what are their differences/limitations? I've heard putting books on an iPod results in getting the order of the chapters shuffled. Is there a way around this?
So pretty much all the tablets have some kind of e-reader function on them. The big limitation is that one of the more popular tablets is the Kindle Fire. And my recollection is that the Kindle Fire only can read books or get ebooks from Amazon's Kindle store. Similarly, the Nook reader or Nook tablet only can get books from Barnes & Noble, not from Amazon. So that's a big limitation if you bought into one or the other store. the Android tablets, the Apple tablets are much more open in that respect. Like the iPads, there are e-reader apps, not only from Apple, the iBook store, but also, you know, there's an Amazon Kindle app for the iPad, there's a Nook reader, there's a Kobo reader, there's all kinds of different ones. In terms of the limitation that they're talking about transferring ebooks to the iPad, I haven't run into that issue. That may be a particular issue having to do with, a particular e-reader or a particular format of ebooks.
What about the really dirt cheap knockoffs that are out there? Do you have any recommendations or any cautions for people that are finding kind of the no-name tablets, $100 or less, some of the Chinese, no-name Chinese tablets and toy stores that are marketed to children?
I have not played a lot with any of those recently. I did test one out last year, and I was very unimpressed with it. You know, in some respects, you get what you pay for. You get with a less expensive tablet, you tend to get cheaper materials that it's built with, so it's not necessarily going to hold up for very long. You tend to get a poor quality processor, so it's going to be a slower experience. You almost certainly don't get the latest version of whatever operating system it's running on, which is usually Android, which means that it's not as easy to use or as user-friendly and may not run the latest applications. And the components are likely not as good as you'd get on other tablets. And the thing is that you can get, you know, a Google Nexus 7 or a Kindle Fire, the latest Kindle Fire, for $200, $250. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not a huge premium or a huge amount of money to spend compared to like a $100 tablet, and you're getting a much, much better device.
Well, Troy Wolverton, thanks for talking about it with us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Troy Wolverton, he's personal technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Coming up, Geek.com's Russell Holley will continue our conversation about the best tech gifts for the holidays. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Christoph Waltz talks about starring in Quentin Tarantino's new film, Django Unchained. Waltz won an Oscar as well as a Golden Globe, BAFTA, and SAG Award for his portrayal of the Nazi SS officer Hans Landa in Tarantino's previous film, Inglourious Basterds. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow and a discussion about how to amend your garden plans over the winter with Ohio's garden sage Deborah Kanapke. That's All Sides tomorrow from 10 until noon. And it's 40 degrees with a chance of rain today, a high of 46. Clouds tonight, a low of 34. Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com. And support comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way is working to improve lives and strengthen our community by bringing together people and organizations to address local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information on how to get involved is at liveunitedcentralohio.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We just finished talking about finding the perfect tablet for that special person on your holiday gift list. Joining us now for more grown-up tech gifts is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
So, real quick, what's your tablet recommendation?
I'm actually a big fan of the iPad Mini right now.
Okay.
I use the iPad Mini and the Nexus 7. Both, you know, they're kind of what I reach for most is the iPad Mini, but they're both great tablets.
You wanted to talk about the Logitech rechargeable touchpad for Windows. I was looking at the videos on it, and it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, we've talked a couple of times about Windows 8, and one of the things that makes Windows 8 a little different is The interface feels like you should be able to reach out and touch your screen in a lot of different places. It's not a requirement that you have a touchscreen. And for a lot of people with desktops who are making the upgrade, you know, it's a little strange. It takes a little bit of getting used to. And what I found was a really great way to take advantage of a lot of the kind of gesture features in Windows 8 that you get, you know, on a touchscreen that you don't get on a desktop was this touchpad from Logitech. It actually replaces the mouse with a touchpad that's a lot larger than what you would see on a laptop. So you've got a lot more room to kind of move around. But it actually recreates a lot of the same gestures that a lot of people are used to on smartphones, like pinch to zoom or you know, dragging across the screen to accomplish certain tasks. You can recreate all of that, you know, with this touchpad instead of having a touchscreen.
I thought it looked really cool. The best way sometimes for me to go is to find people who do those, you know, the ratings from users.
Oh, right.
And one guy wrote that the main beef he had with the product is that it only works well when his fingers are completely dry, which I thought was really strange. He said, my fingers often stick to the surface and make it difficult to navigate. I've never had this problem with trackpads. So do you know much about how it works with the damp fingers?
Well, just like our fingers, just like smartphones, rather, it has a glass coating on the top.
Okay.
And the new MacBooks actually use this exact same technology. It recreates the same touch gestures that we use from smartphones because it uses the same technology. It has a glass coating on the top with the sensors built into it. So if your fingers are wet, then it's going to have trouble picking up, you know, specifically where your finger is, because as electricity moves from your finger to the pad, it's going to spread over a wider area when your finger is wet.
So dry your hands. For heaven's sake, dry your hands. And then there's a margin around the edges of the trackpad that's non-touchable, but it doesn't show up on the trackpad itself. It's all one solid black.
It's all one solid black bar, and it's really just so that you, if you're doing something, you don't drag your finger off the touchpad, which is something that you don't have a problem with on a laptop because you can, you know, you can feel the barrier there. But with a standalone, you know, piece of equipment like this, you kind of need a dead zone for either a place to rest your fingers or, you know, to stop yourself from, you know, dragging your finger off the track and losing whatever it is you were just doing.
Any sense about the ergonomics of it? You know, they've been monkeying around with how to shape those mouses for years now to make them so we're not all getting carpal tunnel syndrome. What about this? Are there any concerns about that?
Well, it's all, you know, kind of individual use cases when it comes to this kind of thing. The advantage that I found in using the Logitech touchpad is that I don't feel the need to rest my hand on the desk at all. Because it's a touchpad, I reach over when I need to use it and I move around and then my hand goes back to my keyboard, which is the same kind of feel that you get with a laptop. You know, you don't usually rest your hand on the laptop where the touchpad is. You reach down and use the touchpad when you feel like you're going to need it. And you get that same experience here. So I guess if someone's doing, you know, just kind of really, you know, basic browsing and they're just kind of chilling on a Saturday afternoon, they could rest their hand on their desk and just kind of lay their hand across the touchpad. And that could cause, you know, some ergonomic issues. But mm-hmm. Really, I don't think most people are going to do that.
Does it take a long time to load this every time you use it?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's just as fast as any other mouse. It's an instant transfer. It's actually, it uses, Logitech has had this really cool thing for a while called the unifying receiver, where if you have multiple Logitech products, it actually only uses one USB port on the back of the device. And I've actually kept, you know, this plugged in for when I do all my normal daily browsing stuff, but I also have my normal mouse for when I play video games.
I
can switch back and forth, and there's never a delay or anything.
My guest, once again, Russell Holley, tech blogger for geek.com. We're talking about gifts for the holidays. It's our last gift show before the holidays, as a matter of fact. If you have a question or comment for Russell, you can run pretty much just about anything by him. He'd be glad to take a swat at it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's also very quick to go to the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Russell, let's turn to the Forus multi-room audio system. It's controlled by smartphones. Is it just for Android phones?
It is currently just for Android phones, but okay. They're going to open it up to other things pretty soon. One of the things that I found, I've played a lot with Bluetooth speakers and things like that. And with Bluetooth speakers, you can really only have the one speaker. And unless you're going to carry the speaker around with you from room to room, a lot of people would really prefer to have just kind of the home, you know, stereo system. What Forest actually allows you to do is you can have the smaller speakers that they sell. They're about $120, and you can purchase as many of those as you want and network them together so that they all play the same music. But if you already have a stereo system, they have a receiver as well that can plug right into the stereo receiver so that you can play the same song throughout your entire house and control it all with your phone.
And how much do they cost? How big are they? Are they just regular size or whatever?
They're
that
really small. I mean, so basically the four speakers are a little tiny bit bigger than what you would expect to see from desktop stereo speakers.
Okay.
So they like computer speakers. They're not too much bigger than that, but the sound is really great from them. And they have a notch in them that you can actually set your phone in to kind of hold it if you want. The receivers that you can plug into your existing stereo equipment are much smaller and they're thin. They're almost like little platters that you can set on top of, you know, your speakers and never have to bother with them. And all of the control and everything is done through your phone.
Is this, can you, for upstairs and downstairs, the whole, it doesn't matter?
I had it connected when I tested these. I have a basement, a middle floor, and a top floor. And it was able to play in all three areas. It connects to your wireless network to link all of these speakers together.
All right.
So as long as you are in range of your wireless network, then you have, you know, everything.
I really like this idea. How expensive are they? Are you going to shoot me down and put a stake
no,
in my
actually,
heart?
No, actually, these are really reasonable. The individual speakers, if you want to go that route, are $120.
Mm-hmm.
And the Forest receivers are about $150.
Okay. Cheaper than a whole new stereo system in each room.
Absolutely.
And what about iPhone equivalent? Is that coming? Is that around the bend or not?
So the way that these work, because they require kind of pretty specific audio equipment, and Apple doesn't share control over iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do some pretty clever programming in order to make it work for the iPhone. But I've been told that they are working on that.
Okay. And how does it actually connect with your Android phone? Is it an app or what?
Right. The Forest app allows you to stream from Pandora or from a couple other, you know, audio services, or just play music that's already on your phone. And because it's all connected through the same stereo system, if you have, you know, a CD player at home or you know, just a regular, you know, hi-fi stereo at home, you can play it all through the same service.
Connie in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome to the show, Connie.
Hi. My question is about security. I have a Nexus 7, and it's a recent gift, and I don't know that much about it, but I was, you know, planning to take it on a vacation, and I was concerned about, you know, like doing my online banking, if it's secure, if I need to get Norton on it, or, you know, well, that's my question.
Okay. So you probably want, you know, some kind of antivirus on it. It's
okay.
Really hard to tell, you know, which brand is better than the others right now. It really depends on, you know, how you're using your computer, you know, what your browsing habits are.
Right.
There are some services like Kaspersky where it runs constantly. It's never not scanning your computer for antivirus software or for you know, virus definitions and things like that, and it's very rapidly updating. So if you have a faster network connection, then this service will allow you to you know, constantly serve. But it's also going to be a little heavier when it comes to your computer's resources. It's going to it's going to make things run a little tiny bit slower depending on how fast your computer is.
Okay. Well, I have Norton on my you know, on my home computer, but I was I was wondering about since you're going to be, you know, on vacation at wireless locations, if I could just, you know, add a Norton program to this and it would be safe.
I mean, Norton is one of the, you know, one of the top antivirus software, you know, systems out there, and it's going to continue scamming. Your system is the thing that you need to be concerned with, not necessarily the network that you're attached to. So, you know, if you're going to be traveling on other people's networks, any antivirus software, as long as it's running, you know, routinely, is going to be the best way to go. So if you get something like Norton, just make sure that you have it set up so that it's scanning on a regular basis.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, Connie. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yep. If you have a question for Russell Holly, 614-292-8513. It's your last chance before Christmas to talk with Russell to get his advice. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So a lot of people are out buying televisions. I was out last weekend looking for gifts, won't say what, but there were a lot of people looking at televisions, and I wondered if we could talk a little bit about that and what
sure.
What kind of advice or what kind of things people should be asking themselves as they go out there.
Especially if you're looking for high-definition televisions, the one kind of funny thing to keep in mind right now is that we've reached a point that everyone is offering the same kind of high-definition television. You see a lot of brands, you know, sometimes they get labeled true HD or real HD, and the difference between these are really non-existent. You know, 1080p, which is, you know, the resolution of these televisions, is going to be the same across all these devices. So if anybody tries to tell you that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, real HD and true HD, then, you know, they're not really, you know, being particularly honest with you. What you do look at when you're getting a television, especially this time of year, is the refresh rate on the television. Sometimes you'll see things like 60 hertz or 120 hertz, and they're measured in this manner. The higher you're going to get is going to affect how it is that you watch things. And it's important to keep in mind that the television that you get from your provider, you know, only comes at 60 hertz. So if you get something that's 120 hertz and 240 hertz, the television kind of messes with the you know, signal as it's coming in a little bit to add that refresh rate, and things look a little funny at first. Your eyes are going to adjust to it over time, but the image is going to seem, you know, almost artificial, if that makes any sense. The other thing that you want to keep in mind is that the brands that are on sale right now, for the most part, these are, you know, kind of end of year models and things like that. And because of that, one of my favorite brands, especially around this time of year, is Vizio, because the Vizio televisions are actually built using components from previous generation of televisions. So they're typically less expensive to begin with, but they focused a lot recently on their own software added into the television in order to make it easier to do a lot of things. So you have a lot of the smart TV functionality, like the ability to stream Netflix and things like that, already built into those televisions, and they're usually much cheaper than the other manufacturers.
Okay, dumb question for the day. Mm-hmm. What's a refresh rate?
I'm
enchanted that you think I actually know what you're talking about sometimes.
So the refresh rate, your screen, you know, shows, you know, video is a set of streaming images.
Mm-hmm.
And every time a new image is displayed on the screen, it refreshes to show the next image. You know, so what you're seeing there is, you know, kind of the constant stream of video. And the refresh rate is how fast your at what frequency your screen refreshes to show you the next image.
Okay. 614-292-8513. We still have a few more minutes with Russell Holly. If you want to get that call in right away, please do so. All right. So just as a refresher course now, your favorite smartphone of the year is?
Oh, the Samsung Galaxy S3 is definitely my favorite all around.
And why? We've talked about them before, but
it's available on just about everything. They've been out for a little while now, but the hardware is still really great. It's definitely going to last a while. Samsung has done really, really great in keeping the software up to date on this phone. The battery life is definitely comparable with the other high-end smartphones out there. And it's, you know, just really they're available in two, you know, pretty decent colors, the pebble blue and the white. If you are not a fan of larger screens, you know, like if you're still using, you know, maybe an iPhone 4 or something like that, then the screen size is a little jarring because it's, you know, it's a larger screen. It's a 4.8 inch screen. But otherwise, it's a really great all around phone.
And the top video streaming sites. You know, we were talking about this, I think, last week about video streaming sites. Is it sort of the sort of thing you give somebody as a gift?
You can definitely give these kind of things as gift cards, as gift services. You know, Amazon and Hulu Plus and Netflix all have, you know, the ability to give those services away as gifts. And each one of them kind of has their own merit, depending on what kind of user you are. But I think the best overall right now is the Netflix service, especially if you have kids. The Netflix for Kids service really kind of simplifies the user interface so that kids can use it and not access, you know, any kind of adult content or any, you know, settings in the Netflix service. And, you know, each one of these, they really stream on just about everything. So if you've got, you know, a smartphone or a tablet or, you know, an Xbox or something like that, chances are you have, you know, the ability to stream this content anyway.
Matt in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, another follow-up on safe computing when you're on somebody else's network. I know my Kaspersky has a virtual keyboard that you can click on instead of, you know, typing your keystrokes. And I imagine Norton has that as well. How is that as far as making sure the passwords don't get stolen and I'm safe for using my machine in a strange place?
Well, I mean, in a funny way, it doesn't really help at all. In that, you know, the packets get captured either way. If someone's, you know, maliciously looking to capture packets as they leave your PC and you're on their network, then they can do that. It's really just, you know, how many steps you're putting in between them and finding the answer. Which again, if you know, there's malicious intent there, they're going to grab it regardless. I mean, the virtual keyboard system, you know, kind of it adds that in. That encrypted layer, but it's not stopping the call and response, you know, for the password being, you know, given. So it's one of those things where it's nice if you're dealing with an amateur, but you know, if in the environment that you just presented, it's not going to help at all.
So I shouldn't imagine that I'm safe by doing that.
Right.
Well, okay. Thank you.
All right, Matt.
No problem.
Thanks for the call. Michael, we've got maybe 20 seconds. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I'd love to ask a question about the iPad and whether it's usable for, like, photoshopping pictures. And if not, is there another alternative for a tablet?
It depends on what kind of photo manipulation you want to do. Photoshop is a really intricate, heavy program, so a lot of those features aren't available. If you're just looking for basic image manipulation, you want to adjust the contrast or do some basic cropping and things like that. iPhoto is really great. Snapseed is phenomenal. And there is a Photoshop app that allows for, you know, for some basic image manipulation as well. But understand that none of those are even close to being as powerful as the actual Photoshop app.
Okay, Russell Holly, I hope you have a wonderful holiday. Thanks so much for all your help this season.
No, thanks for having me. It's
Russell Holly, Geek.com tech blogger. Thanks to everybody for listening today. Thanks as well to my staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Katie Higgins, Leticia Wiggins, Rose Joe. Video production by Rich and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.